This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress. Excuse me. I'm just getting over COVID. Look, I know this isn't what her cave suits are for. Full disclosure. I know they're for caving, but if they're for caving, then they're good enough for a lot of other things too, aren't they? And I don't expect you to use them for this as well, but I thought this was fun. So a few weeks ago, we got a good snow here in Indiana, central Indiana. Maybe you can see where this is going. The kids, of course, have their snow pants and their boots and their coats, all of which we have to replace every year because they're growing like weeds. Adults, we have coats that we've owned for years. When was the last time you as an adult put on a pair of snow pants or something like that? My wife didn't have anything that would work for sledding. We were going to take our kids sledding. She said, wait, would my Sophie suit work? I said, absolutely. Great idea. And of course, it did work. I think Sophie put my wife's picture on Instagram last month, her in her cave suit. Up on the sledding hill. I'm not sure if it's still up there, but I thought that was nice of Sophie. She makes the best cave suits you've ever seen and does these cool bat stencils for a little added style. She can make you one too. Her suits come in all kinds of colors. She's a one-woman business based in Philly. Custom cave suits made to order. Find her at SophieReaptress.com and on Instagram at SophieReaptress. She's a caver. Of course she's a caver, so she knows what you need. Good thick Cordura to resist the rigors and abrasion of the hardest cave trips. Order yours at SophieReaptress.com and tell her the Caving Podcast sent you. Thank you very much. Well, hey, how's it going? Matt Pelser from the Central Indiana Grotto. This is the Caving Podcast. It's a monthly podcast for cavers by cavers. But if you're new to caving and you're interested, of course you're welcome here. Just a heads up, caving's like a lot of things, can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. Quite the opposite, though, once you get a little experience. And the only way to get experience, as far as we're concerned, the safest way anyway, is to go with experienced people. And the best way to do that is to join your local grotto. Grotto is like a local chapter of the National Speleological Society here in the United States. Internationally, I mean, there are caving clubs in most countries. Find your club, find your grotto if you're in the U.S. I've got a link in the description of this podcast. And go to a meeting, make some friends so you can go on one of the greatest adventures of your life safely. This month is part two of my long talk with Rand Hazlett from Indiana. And he leads the Binkley Project, which is the longest cave in Indiana. And we're going to talk a lot about that in this episode. We talked about it in the last episode. I am so glad that this was such a long talk because his caving life is deep. If you missed part one, you can still hang around, of course, but you'll get a lot of context in part one that could serve you well here in part two. So in my opinion, you should check that out first. But I wanted to share this before we get into part two here. I meant to include this at the end of the last episode, but what ended up being posted didn't include this. I picked the wrong file. It's a long story. I decided to just wait until this month to say this. Just a few weeks after we did this interview, he sent me a message to let me know that he had been to the doctor because he hadn't been feeling well. And he found out that he had a big blood clot in his heart. He used the term widowmaker and said that it was either the same thing or similar to what got his friend Tim McLean, who we talked about in the last episode. And get this, the doctor said that it was because of his active lifestyle, a pretty good deal of which is caving, of course, that saved him. I wasn't keeping count, but there were a bunch of occasions in the last interview, and I think a couple in this one, in which he said caving saved his life. And just in the latter part of 2023, add another occasion to the list there. At the bottom of the message that he sent me, he said, whatever you do, don't stop caving. It can save your life. Rand, I'm so glad you didn't stop caving. Not that you ever would. I'm glad you're still here. I'm glad you got to go to Mexico this past month. Yeah, you made it down there. Despite the news, he still went. And he's going to keep going underground, pushing the gnarliest leads in Indiana and elsewhere, which he talks about in this month's episode. Here is part two of my talk with Rand Hazlett.
So Binkley continues to be kind of your main project, but I mean, if we were to step away from Binkley, you've done an awful lot.
Yeah. Well, we added
since then as well.
Well, we just to tell you what's happened with Binkley in a sense, in a nutshell, you know, even after Dave's left 10 years later, we've added 11 miles.
Yeah.
So, I mean, from that trip there, we've added basically another 11 miles. We just crossed 46 miles.
Wow.
So, you know, that's it may not have continued in Dave's style, but it still continued. But, yeah, so after Tim died, one of the things that I've been looking at was, you know, I never got to go to TAG, and I never got to go to Mexico or do any of that stuff. And that had always been something I wanted to do, but I'd had that vertical experience. And, mm-hmm. you know, we used scaling poles and we had nuisance drops and stuff and all. And I wasn't really, you know, vertically skilled to do that. And I ended up...
So just to let everybody know, you go into Binkley, you're not bringing vertical gear.
Generally not.
I mean, and there are vertical elements, but you take care of that with scaling poles and things like that.
The rock is really crappy.
Yeah.
You know, setting bolts and stuff, and even natural anchors aren't really great options usually. And the things to climb up to them, I've done a few bolt climbs in there, but a scaling pole is the answer almost always.
All right.
Anyway, so... Tim and I had talked about going on Tony and Marion's Acres expeditions in Mexico. They've been leading those for a number of years. And we were going to go the following year, but then he died that November. So that April, I actually had kind of a little Tim Fest kind of thing at my place to celebrate Tim and all that was going on. And Tony and Marion were there. And I was already doing caving with Marion, and we'd become really good friends and stuff. And I had she said, well, talk to Tony about going to Mexico. And I said, I really wanted to go. And so he invited me on their expedition that next year. And so he said, but you got to get, you know, more vertically proficient. You know, we're dropping, you know, big pits and stuff there. And so I talked to Ron Adams and things and lined some stuff up with him, started practicing, got some other gear. Tony helped me buy the right gear. And then I went to do Ellison's.
Fire.
Well, I mean, what the hell? So, yeah, I mean, do I have time for a little story on Ellison?
Sure, of course.
So
Ellison's story? Always.
Ellison's story, yeah, which also includes the, you know, Marion Smith, the old goat. So
he was there?
Well, he was. He was kind of part of it. Because we went to his place to stay.
Okay.
And so we went to Marion's and stayed there. And Marion's going, well, you know, that's quite a drop there, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And he's not doing much to make me feel a whole lot better about it.
He's nothing you didn't know.
Right, no, he's the old curmudgeon. Well, just to back up for one moment with Marion Smith, I met him in Binkley's a few years before that. I don't have the history of so many tag cavers and stuff had Marion, but he met me and goes, you are far more interesting in person than I thought you would be. So that was the most backhanded compliment that you could get from Marion, but so perfectly Marion.
Yeah.
And ended up that for a number of years thereafter until his death before Tagfall Cave, and Ron Adams and I wouldn't go down and go caving with him for a day or so. And I got a number of Marion Smith trips in. So I felt really privileged to get to know him, even if it was later in life and do all that. But anyways, back to Ellison's. So had all the rope and everything. We went up the top of the hill with Ron Adams and Adam Scher, a couple other people I didn't really know at the time. And Ron rigged it from the attic. And, you know, first of all, we had to get down and go through the nuisance drop. So pull the rope out of the bag, and rats chewed the rope in half for the warm-up pit.
Oh, no.
So we have to tie a knot.
Oh, goodness.
In the rope. Oh. So my first pit that's already, the first part of the pit that I'm going to have to do, which is already deeper than the deepest drop I've already done, which was still Parker's pit at that time, and the warm-up pit's like 120 feet, you know, I have to cross a knot in the middle of it.
Oh, great.
So here I am being tested there like that. So I do it, no real problems or anything. We get on down there, and then Ron rigs from the attic, you know, the big drop, I think, was it 587, 586,
that's
something.
That's the
longest one.
Yeah.
And so we all go down and we drop it and start climbing up, and people are climbing tandem. And so Ron wants me to climb tandem with him. And we get about 100 feet off the floor, and Ron goes, I don't think I can have you climbing tandem under me. You know, the rope's just killing my crotch. You know, it's busting the boys.
Well, okay, but what do you do?
So you're going to have to change over and rappel down and wait until I climb out to get out. So here I am, my first time in Ellison's, you know. I've only done a changeover a few times, you know, all practice situations. I've never had to do a changeover in a real-life situation. So, and along racks, you know, so I successfully get in, do a changeover, get down to the bottom, and wait until Ron gets up and, you know, lets me know the rope's clear. And I climb out and I survive my first Ellison's trip.
Okay.
But I had to cross a knot and I had to do a changeover.
Wow.
So I got the full Monty there in a sense. It was the full experience. But what a great thing, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And I did some more vertical practice and we did some other pits, you know, Kegel's Chasm and a bunch of other stuff there, Tagfall Cave. And,
so doing Ellison's, did that wig you out at all? I mean, since it was your first big experience since Parker's?
Absolutely. I mean, I had a real fear, not of heights. I'm not afraid of exposure of heights, but actually being on rope. I had to come to grips to trust my gear.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, if I got myself in something, I'd get myself out or that my friends would help get me out. I just had to, you know, put my faith in what I had.
That's a hurdle, though.
It was. And I have to say that the mental strength that I developed in Binkley's helped me to more easily transition to that. I mean, obviously, people climb Ellison's all the time, but, you know, I had this predisposition to not really liking vertical or wanting to do it.
And then all of a sudden, you're doing the biggest drop in the continental United States.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, when I do things, I tend to just go in and do them, as you've seen. So,
yeah.
So anyway, so this is all in preparation to go to Mexico,
yeah.
Which was the whole reason.
Drops.
Yeah, yeah. So I got invited to go January to Mexico, and I made my plane reservations and stuff, and I had gotten two rocks from where Tim had passed away, and I had given one to Tony and Marion Akers, and I kept another one. At the time when I met them, I just felt like, you know, it was something I was supposed to do. Tony and Marion gave me back. Well, they took the stone and had it made into a necklace and gave it to me.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
So when I went to Mexico, I wore that stone necklace the whole time that I was there, kind of taking a piece of Tim with me throughout that. But Mexico was amazing, phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, just another world. Culturally, I mean, and where we went, I mean, and I know there's the big expeditions like Pesh and, you know, and Cheve and all that. Tony and Marion's expeditions, they were smaller. You know, we're talking, you know, 10 people or so. And I mean, they're embedded into the culture. 10, 12 people. Met Mike Frazier, the phenomenal caver. Cheve background, Tres Amigos, you know, Chinny Chow, all sorts of stuff. I mean, just one of the best out there, still doing stuff with Cheve and I think Pesh and some stuff. But he lives in part-time in Mexico there. And Tony and Marion actually own part of a coffee plantation where we were staying at there in Mexico. I mean, we got up into the mountains, the cloud forest here, and all of a sudden the fog breaks and the sky is just brightest stars I've ever seen. I'm on this terrace here where they've spread the coffee out, you know, 100 years ago. But before that, that terrace was built on the remains of some ancient civilization that lies right underneath it there, you know, that used it for other things. I mean, the history is just, I mean, layer after layer after layer. The place is magical. Here's this big mastiff that's part of the Cerro Bone, you know, right up behind, you know, the plantation. I mean, it's just like, well, we ain't in Kansas anymore, Toto. and it was just like unbelievable. And it just, the rest of the expedition was like that. You know, we went into this area, this little town called, well, it wasn't even a town. It was actually, had been kind of a little settlement called Arco Eris. And it was, I think the closest town to it was Rio Santiago, which was in the Sierra Mazatec. We're in the Sierra Mazatec and part of the Cerro Ribon. And we have to get porters to help us get all our stuff up on top of the hill. We set up this camp and there's pits everywhere. Big, mm-hmm. deep jungle pits. Nobody's ever been in or done. And, you know, Mike Frazier's rigging pits here and we're dropping over here and Tony's rigging pits and we're dropping stuff over here. I mean, you go around a rock and there's a pit, you know, there's stuff all over here. And for a guy who's not a pit bouncer, you know, here's all the stuff. But of course, I'm always looking, all right, how do we get deeper? Where's the cave? You know, I'm looking for more than just the pit, you know, I'm looking for the pit being the entrance to the rest of the cave system, you know, and stuff. But, I got to do this one, and I think it ended up being a little over 300 feet deep, like 320 feet deep, El Mejor. And that was my first really big one. And Mike Frazier rigged it, had this really funky hanging rear belay right over the top of it, and it took a real trick move to do. But it was like, it all worked, and I did it. And it was just like such an amazing experience and an accomplishment. You know, I felt like, once again, you know, I had made myself push my personal boundaries, do things that I was scared of, and I was rewarded with these incredible experiences. And that's been caving over and over again.
Yeah.
If I'll put my faith in the people, my gear, and myself, I'm bound to have an amazing experience. Don't do something just stupid and half-assed. You know, you've got to do it right. But if you're willing to push yourself and trust the people that you're with and surround you with the right ones, you're going to find something. Mm. Maybe not what you thought, but you're definitely going to find something.
Well, you found stuff.
Yes. Well, they found over 92 different caves that they notated throughout their series of expeditions that they had. And I was fortunate enough to go, I think, 5 different trips there. Some of them were not so pleasant. We had cartels enter.
Right.
Yeah. We were in Tenango, and we were trying to get to this area called the Lost City, which had a cave called Breath of Ostoto there. And it was one of the deepest caves they found, and I want to say it was 900 feet deep or so, something like that, or deeper. Anyway, we encountered on the way trying to get there, because it's several days bushwhacking, hiking after you set up camp.
Wow.
We started running into this illegal logging operation that's protected biosphere. And so here were all these massive acote trees, you know, that were cut down, and they were using chainsaw mills to mill up the trees. So they couldn't actually, the big bottoms of the trunks were too big for the chainsaw mills to do it. So you had all these massive trunks laid and just the tops cut up into lumber all over the place.
Mm.
And it was really heartbreaking. But at the same time, we got up to this point and we found these series of pits, and we were throwing rocks in them, and they were going 5 seconds. So
wow.
we just found 2 of these side by side, 5-second pits.
Wow.
And so we turned around and decided we would come back to camp, take a day at camp, then come back prepared to assault all these. And some folks went that day to go do another pit in the jungle that they'd agreed to do with some locals. And we were in camp, and Marion was there, and I was there, and some of the other folks. And Marion and I were finally getting a shower. We hadn't gotten a shower. So here we are taking showers and stuff. And all of a sudden, this guy comes up through the woods. And we don't know who it is, so we run into our tent and stuff and all and everything. And he's trying to talk through us through the tent. And we finally get him to go away, and we get back out, and we go back in main camp. And all of a sudden, all these guys converge into the center of camp, and they've got guns, and the guns are cocked.
Oh my gosh.
They're not happy. So some of them are actually officials of the state, and the other ones are like from the logging camp. So they saw us hit the logging area. We ran into one person, and so it had been reported back, and they've been looking for us for days now, trying to track our trail back to where our camp was. And probably if we had not been who we were, if we had been locals, we probably would not be alive today.
Really?
Yeah. But they're
trying to protect their illegal operation.
Yes. I mean, there's
trying to keep anyone
whether
from
it's
talking.
Cartel or just a community trying to make money or a combination. Hard to say, but they're cutting wood that they're not even supposed to be able to export.
Right.
I mean, it's that kind of thing. So it's likely that an illegal element is involved in that. Anyway. Tony and Marion had to go down off the mountain to be in Tenango that next day and meet with the authorities. And they did. They went down and they came right back up. Of course, we're waiting the whole time, sweating it out. And they come up and said, we have to be off in 24 hours. And then we have to be back down to basically go to court in Tenango there. And so here where we've taken, you know, all the stuff that we've had that took like 3 or 4 different loads to get up the hill has to come down in one day.
Gosh.
We got one group of people to kind of help us take stuff down, and everything else had to come down on our backs. I was coming down the hill, and I slipped and fell and rolled my ankle. I mean, really, really bad one way. And I was able to get my – and I mean, immediately sick in my stomach. And I got back up, and I didn't take another three steps, and I fell and rolled my ankle the other way. I mean, my ankle was destroyed. And so I'm sitting there. Everybody's got completely full packs. We've got a couple of hours at least to get down the mountain. And it's like, what do you do? Well, I'm a believer in always carrying some pain medication, and I had pain pills, and so I chewed up a couple of pain pills, got a pole, I got my folks to stand me up and get me on there, and I didn't stop until I got to the bottom of the mountain. And as soon as I took my sock off, my foot, my leg swelled up like three times what it was normally supposed to be. And that was the end of my expedition. We did have to go to the court the next day, and they ordered us out of there and not to come back. And they had just recently gotten the government reestablished, a local government authority established back in town. So they weren't willing, even though we had permission. We had gone through all the proper channels. We weren't
sure,
just
they
trespassing.
Always did.
Right. Yes. Tony's incredible about that. I mean, he is. He truly respects the indigenous people, and he tries to follow their rules to a T. He shows nothing but the ultimate respect. We're small, we're stealth, we're part of the community, we're embedded, and we respect everybody. If it were not for his skills, we would never have gotten access to begin with, and if it were not for he and Marion's skills in working with the people, we wouldn't have gotten out of there.
Right.
So.
Wow. That's something else.
It is. These are real, true life experiences, as John Benton would say. And that's what we're after. I mean, you know, it's in the end, the cave is kind of a means to have all these other adventures, too. The culture, I mean, what I'm exposed to culturally here, I mean, I'm not seeing it just from a gringo's perspective. Mm. I mean, I'm really in there, you know, trying to keep my mouth shut. I know that's hard to imagine here, but I keep my mouth shut and watching. I don't speak the language, but I mean, I'm seeing things. I'm seeing, you know, the new world hitting the old world, you know, all of this stuff that's just unbelievable. And then the landscape and the caves and then the people that are going there. I mean, it's just, it's really hard to put into words. It's just so amazing. But it's the overall adventure. It becomes not just one piece of it, but all those things, whether, you know, it's cultural and environmental and, you know, and the cave.
Well, okay, so that happened a few years ago. Have you been back since then?
Yes, we went back.
Different area, though, obviously.
Right. We went to a really cool area that was San Juan Cuautespan, which was a Mixtec area rather than Mazatec, and we had an amazing time up there, really without incident. But we got into this virgin rainforest up there, and our Thomas Hawkins, who you interviewed, he's been going on he's part of the expeditions too. And one of the really cool things, you know, along with finding some really major, impressive deep caves there, was we were finding, he's a botanist. He's a trained botanist. And we'd always go, Thomas, what's this? He'd go, oh, well, that's that. And, well, Thomas, what's this over here? Oh, well, that's a type of orchid, blah, blah, blah. And what's this, Thomas? He goes, I don't know. I don't know what that is. I mean, God, what is this? Pull this. Let's get a picture of this. I need to find out what this is. I mean, and he's just getting so excited. It's just unbelievable. And we're up in this pristine area, and these people have never even stayed overnight on their property. You know, they're kind of like tribes, you know, these small communities. They're very closely knit communities, but this community had never even stayed on their property at that level overnight. Mm. They didn't even know what they had up there, but they knew that they didn't want people up there timbering, and they need to protect it to preserve their water supply. And we actually got them to stay overnight for the first time ever. And actually one of the women from the community came up and stayed overnight too, which was a really big deal for the community.
Yeah.
And so we got to be part of that cultural experience with them too. But the other highlight along the Thomas thing was there, we found an insectivore plant that is almost never seen in the wild, called Pinguicula. And we all kind of found it. And so we came back. Thomas evidently found something. We came back and we found Thomas. And we go, look at this picture. Thomas found this thing. He goes, that's Pinguicula. I saw it. You know how many times that's actually been seen and photographed in the wild and all this kind of stuff? I mean, he's just going nuts over it. It's like, and it kind of looks like hens and chickens is kind of what it looks like. But it's on these walls. And we even found one blooming. But I mean, everywhere you looked was this biodiversity, probably half of it is endangered, undocumented, or almost never seen by human people.
Wow.
I mean, it's just, once again, it's kind of like caving, going someplace where no other human being maybe has ever been before. It's easy to set a step still up there where no person, human being at least, has ever been.
You get the same kind of feeling from that.
It is, yeah. Yeah. And so to get that in the cave and out of the cave and this tight bonding with all the people, you know, your caving family here. I mean, these bonds and these experiences, I mean, it becomes, you know, almost a singularity. I don't know how to, a shared reality, you know, and it's very deep and it's very special. And so when things go bad, it can be even more so difficult. The last time we were there, we didn't get to go to our original objective, and we ended up at this in Jalapa, and we went to a small cliff cave up on the top, and we had we had not been sure if we were going to go because that Christmas Eve, the president and some other members of his cabinet or whatever were shot dead in the head by cartel at a Christmas party.
Oh,
but
gosh.
We were talked in by the tourism director to go ahead and come and go. And Mike Frazier was really deeply involved with this. And so we went ahead and went back up there. And we had a really nice trip. It was great. And the tourism director, Tatiana, her brother actually went with us. And he kind of stayed with us and was our tour guide. And this guy, I mean, he was just so great. He took to caving like a bird takes to air. He was tying knots. He was climbing. He was sitting there. He was just loving it. I mean, he was the nicest soul you could possibly imagine. And we fell for him and he fell for us. And we came off the mountain having had this just great experience. Except while we were up there, the Brothers Aliasco cartel had invaded the town. And they were radio broadcasting for 21 people to turn themselves in, or they were going to kill them and all the rest of their families.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it happens that his sister, the tourism director, was one of the people that was being called up. Well, so we came off the mountain earlier and didn't finish up all of our projects. And long story short, we went ahead and left. And we had found another cave at base camp in Carlota where Marion and Tony's property is and where they stay. And it was a really cool little multi-drop through water, and it needed to be de-rigged. So our guide was going to come back from Jalapa. He was getting on a bus to come help Tony and Aida, his girlfriend, de-rig that cave. And he was killed boarding the bus by cartel people.
Oh my gosh.
And it apparently potentially had something to do with, you know, him participating in the caving thing and all. So that really kind of changed things. So
I would imagine.
Yeah. So we haven't gone back since that happened. That was, what, 2020, I think.
Right
prior to the pandemic. And so that was really the last time that we've been. And we're actually going back to Mexico this year for the first time since that's happened. And things seem to have settled down. And so really excited about going back there. But it's also a bit tentative, too. And there's going to be, you know, some things that we're going to have to emotionally face, as well as, you know, once again, it's Mexico as beautiful as it is brutal. And I'll just tell this one quick little thing. When I first got to Mexico, this kind of sums up Mexico. The town right before Huautla that you get to they sit right on the edge of the cliff. I mean, there's more of the building hanging out over the edge of the cliff with about a 1,000-foot drop than there is on the road. And wow. I mean, then there's trucks and trailers and some of this is one of the bigger small towns right there. And I remember, so I'm in this super cab bus, which is actually a very nice kind of super van. Anyway, I'm looking out and all of a sudden there's three dogs out in the road and this tractor trailer semi runs over one of them. The other two dogs run up and grab the other dog that's just been hit and pull it out of the road over into the sidewalk area and over where they are. And they're just there and you know, trying to take care of it. And everything else is still going on. Nobody paused for a second.
Wow.
But it just kind of in a moment summed up to me. It's like, this is the beauty and the brutality of Mexico. Here you are with this amazing, fabulous landscape and all this out here. And this is the reality and how quickly life and events can change.
Wow.
But that struck me right then when it happened there. And over again, I see that happening to that dog and those other dogs coming to its aid, kind of being almost an example of what it's like to be in the Sierra.
The parallels.
The parallels, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. So, what do you want to talk about the back injury?
Oh, well, you know, so I do have a... So
this is going back about a year from where we were just speaking, right?
Yeah. So, well, actually it was that August before that trip, so where we were in Jalapa, it was actually at a cave, Capers, in a cave that I will not name.
Okay.
We were doing some project caving, and we were way back in.
This is back home in Indiana.
Back home in Indiana at a cave, Capers. Found a passage and pushing some low water airspace, broke out into a nice big room, waterfall and stuff and all, not real far from a main entrance and stuff and all. And I was back there with friend Brad Barkham and stuff and all, and we got there before the rest of the team, and we were going over and looking at all this stuff, and it was really good find. There was an alcove that looked like it had passage going off of the side of it, and I said, well, man, I'm real like get up there. And we stacked a couple rocks up, and he said, well, I'll give you, you know, a hand up, a foot up. And so I got up and put my foot in his hands and, you know, was going to climb up, get on top of that. Well, and somewhere in the midst of all that, I lost my footing and I flipped over backwards and I fell 10 feet onto a pile of rocks on my back. The pile of rocks shattered, and I knew I had done something, but I didn't know what I had done exactly. And I was trying to get in shape again because I had a number of expeditions coming up, which was Mexico, and then I was going to go to Vietnam and stuff all coming up the next year, plus we're trying to do that. So I was working, doing a bunch of core exercises and doing a lot of setups, and I credit that for not having done more damage because we actually did a little bit more survey, and I took myself on out, and I went to Cave Capers the rest of the night last night. And I remember sitting across the table from Don Paquette, and he goes, are you all right? And I said, well, I'm here.
Aren't I?
And he kind of gave me one of those looks, and I didn't know how bad it was. I went to the immediate care center and had an x-ray. They can't tell. I can't have MRIs because of my pacemaker.
Right.
And he goes, I can't see anything. They sent me back to another doctor. They sent me to a spine doctor. And he goes, well, you've broken your back. You've got some transverse fractures here. And so I went back a couple times. He said, I said, all right, well, so like how long am I down for? And he goes, well, you're down 6 weeks before you can start resuming activity. So I said, all right, well, 6 weeks. Well, if I do that, then I can still make these expeditions and do this if I do it. So I went back home and I couldn't do certain things, but I could walk. So I was walking like 5-6 miles a day and stuff and all. And I had a couple doctor appointments like, okay, yeah, you're progressing. And then each time I go in, they say, oh, well, there's another break. You know, there's another break. So I finally get to the 6 week mark and it's Tagfall Cave In. So I go and I do Gordonette Cave and I do Well of Souls. And because, you know, it's been 6 weeks, right?
Sure.
So I can go caving, right? So right after I get back from that, I go to see the doctor and he takes another series of x-rays. And I'm looking back there and going, man, what are all these spots here? And He comes in and he goes, how's it going? Good, good. He goes, I said, what are all these things here? He goes, well, that's a fracture. 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 That's a fracture.
Whoa.
That's a herniated disc and that's a bulging disc. So he said, you have 5 transverse fractures, 1 bulging disc and 1 herniated disc. But you're doing really good. So I'm going to release you to go to warm water aerobics. And I'm sitting here going, I hate to tell you this, but I've already been rappelling and climbing doing all of this.
Did it hurt?
I'm a little beyond warm water aerobics. And he just kind of threw his hands up and he said, you know what? There's nothing more I can do for you. He said, just remember, you need to take at least 2,000 units of vitamin D every day for the rest of your life, and your bones are only half as strong as they were when you were 24 years old.
Oh my gosh.
You're obviously motivated to get better, but he said, you're not a kid anymore.
Was there pain associated with this? I mean, you're doing all this stuff.
Well, sure.
But you didn't. You just chalked it up to, you know, I'm the age that I am, and... Okay.
Well, I mean, I've separated both my shoulders, you know, I've got knees that have been injected, you know, I've got bone spurs and shoulder injuries, or elbow injuries. I mean, I have gout in both feet that I've had to have worked on and stuff. I mean, pain's my friend, you know, the big thing is you just can't stop. So it's like, oh, all right. So when is the pain causing damage, or when is the pain just a remnant from the damage you've already done?
Right.
And so. So, you know, I'm just at the point where, you know, I just keep going. And most of the time I feel good.
Mm, goodness. All right. Well.
So the other thing that was kind of important to me was my time in Roppel Cave. Because that was early on. That was right after I finished doing the Indiana Caverns 2. It was part of spreading my wings, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
So. Let me just say that kind of goes in. I got Caver of the Year, and I didn't feel like that I was really worthy of Caver of the Year because I hadn't done vertical work. I hadn't done international exploration, and I really hadn't done anything other than Binkley's. So it was like, how could I be Caver of the Year?
But CIG Caver of the Year is to recognize an Indiana caver doing Indiana things.
Well, I know, but I mean,
among other things.
I know, but this was what was going in my mind. You know, it's like, so I got this award, but, you know, it's like, am I really deserving of it? I mean, I felt really honored, and it's one of the most special things I've ever gotten was to get this Caver of the Year award. But it's like, you know, all my caving is really within 30 miles of where I was born, you know.
Yeah, but there's a lot of cave down there.
Well, there is, but it's almost all Binkley, you know. I mean, even if I got 24 miles, been in on 24, 25 miles of cave, you know, it was still all at home. You know, I had National Geographic experience during the day and slept in my own bed at night. You know? But that was the great thing about it. But, you know, I did it for fun. I didn't think that it was necessarily worthy of Caver of the Year, but at the same time, I was thrilled, but it was like, I need to do more. I always wanted to do stuff in Mammoth Cave. Holly McClintock asked me to come down and do Speleofest and do a presentation, particularly on the Indiana Caverns development and what had happened in Binkley's. And so I did that, and we became really good friends, and we started doing caving in Roppel. And being the guy I am and knowing how to use drills and different things, and she had some projects, and, you know, we hit it off great. And so I started going to Roppel, you know, a few times a year, and was blasting open these canyons and stuff like that, and we were finding stuff.
Yeah.
So some of the coolest things that she found, I got to be a small part of that. You know, like Eros Way, I think, was what she ended up naming, Jump Around Dome.
Yeah,
and some things. I even have a little survey called the RH Survey. It's named after me in Roppel. So, you know, I even got to do some stuff in the biggest cave in the world, along with then trying to get ready to go do the Mexico stuff and do that. So it was kind of like, you know, all right, this Indiana cave, he's going to become more than just an Indiana caver.
Yeah.
You know, spread my wings and finally see what the hell I can really do.
Boy, talk about a caver's cave.
It is. And that goes back to Pete Cresselius, who was one of the original ISS cavers that I caved with. He left Binkley's cave to go cave in Roppel, and he logged 20 miles in Roppel Cave. I mean, just miles and miles and miles, and was really well known. Cresselius Boulevard and Roppel is named after him, things like that. So it was really neat to get to go where another ISS caver had gone and made his mark.
Yeah, but, Roppel.
Yeah. So that's I try and get a trip once or twice a year with Holly down there.
Yeah.
So it's always fun.
That's a cool place. I'd love to get involved down there too.
Well, they're always looking for people.
I'm sure that they are. And I'm always looking for more time.
Aren't we all?
One thing we didn't cover yet, and this kind of goes back in the timeline, and it's a story that's been told on the show before. I mean, the flood. You were there in 2016. You were in that group in Binkley.
Well, not only that, I was the leader.
You were the leader.
Yeah. That certainly is a milestone in my caving career, and that probably came closer to making me stop caving too than Tim's death did.
Really?
Mainly because... you want me to tell the whole story? What do you want? You want a synopsis?
I got Marion's side. I got Laura's side. I recently got Trey's side.
Right.
You know, and so I don't know that I need the whole thing, but, a little bit of your perspective on it.
Let me just kind of set it up then, I guess. The best thing to say is, first of all, when we went in, it was all acceptable limits. We knew that we could easily withstand a couple of inches of rain in the cave system anywhere and not being a problem. It had been really cold, but it had gotten warm. Ground was thawed out on the surface, although below the surface it was still frozen. Got in the cave. The water was at a lowest level I'd ever seen it. We got back to our objective, and the water was only a couple inches deep. We went on up into Fantastic Avenue, and we started to go through the DMB crawl, and that's where we started noticing that there was the water problem. And Marion and I and Jesse Getham were all the way at the end through the water when Trey was coming by one of the domes and said, "Hey, it seems like there's more water coming in here." And Laura and Sarah are already in the back saying, "I don't know if Sarah wants to go through the water and stuff." And I said, "What color is that? That seems like a lot of water. What color is that water?" And Trey said, "It's chocolate." I said, "Get the hell out of here." And so we all turned around, got out of there, and the water was already starting to come up in the passage. And Marion kind of got off trail and got over to one side and got into deeper water and trying to get everybody out of there. It was just kind of a real, panic cluster getting everybody out. And we got out and we got up on top and we celebrated by going, "Oh my gosh," and eating our food and having a nice big meal and hot tea and stuff and all. Little did we know that when we got back to the river where we climbed up, the water had gone from being a couple of inches now to being over my shoulders.
Wow.
That's when we knew we were in deep doo-doo. Jeez. And so the big problem was that one of our people on the trip, Seth, was military. And he was due back on base the next day.
Otherwise, I didn't know that.
Otherwise, he was going to be AWOL. So here I am, the leader of this group. I've got Sarah, who hadn't been on a trip this far back, this is the furthest trip for a number of people. And I've got a guy, that in 24 hours is going to be absent without leave.
The understanding had to be there, though. Once everybody knew what had happened and everything, did he get in trouble?
I think he got grilled pretty good in the end and all and stuff.
All right.
But, he didn't suffer any truly adverse consequences, I don't think. But
that's still a big deal.
It is. And here I am. So the one thing I would like to relate about this. So we waited about 14 hours and the water had gone down about 2.5 feet in the pool where we were. So it was about waist deep. And so we decided to make see if we could get out an exit. We started to go back opposite the way we came in. It's a longer route, but it's less crawling and we thought the water would be better. Got out into the main cave, and it was unlike I'd ever seen it. It was not the same cave. I'd never been in that cave before, and I'd been in that part of the cave 50 times.
It's I know where we are, but this is not
this
it.
Does not, this isn't Kansas anymore again, yeah. And so I'm going, all right, what are we going to do? So we start working our way down the stream, and I get to this place. We've gone about a half mile maybe, and there's this hole in the ceiling where the water's just coming down. It's like a 6 foot wide pressurized fire hose. It had been a dome where I'd had a scaling pole in before with a drip coming out of it. I mean, you know, it does not like this. And there's this maelstrom that's going around it. I'm sitting there going, oh my gosh, can we get around this? And so I ask everybody to wait there. I tried to work my way on around the side of that to see if I get going. Well, I got washed away. Got my feet washed out from underneath me and washed down past this thing. I thought I was going. I was able to actually finally grab and claw the wall and get enough footing and perch to pull myself back up. But by the time I got back there, I was just like, I was crushed. I was like, oh my God, I have just killed everybody. Here we are. We left our safe place. We're over half a mile away from that location now. I'm completely wasted. What are we going to do? And I'm shaking. I mean, I'm hypothermic because of what's just happened to me. Because, I mean, what turns out later was that was sumped. If I had gotten sunked any further down, I would have hit a ceiling sump and could have easily been the end of it. Mm-hmm. But so Laura sat down. I sat on her lap and Marion sat on mine and they got me warmed up. And then we just got on the bank and we started crawling and making our way back to our safe spot. And we warmed back up, and I tell you what, that group of people, I was just sure that I just killed everybody, you know. And I felt responsible because I was the leader, and that I had made a poor decision not staying where I should have stayed. And I, in part, did that because I was trying to get Seth out so he could get back in time and not be, you know, AWOL. And I took a risk I shouldn't have taken. It was foolish. We're just fortunate that we had a bunch of really good people on that team and that everybody kept their heads and we will get back there, and we waited and our friends came and got us.
Yeah. Well, and for what it's worth, every iteration of the story that's ever been told to me has never said that, that like Rand led us astray or anything like that, you know?
That's what a leader carries.
Yes,
I think.
Of course.
That's the role. And I think, you know, Being the person who's responsible for the trips, for running the trips, for the people and the personnel that are allowed to come on, what they have, and who ultimately kind of makes the decisions about what they do or they don't, that I felt like, you know, that was on me.
Mm. I mean, I guess it only makes sense for you to carry that.
Well, whether it is or not, I will say that it has shaped my sense of responsibility and leadership ever since.
Okay.
You know, how I handle those things, that yes, everybody's responsible for themselves to some degree, but you know that I need to be on top of my game, you know, when I'm in the cave. You know, I can't be, this isn't wreck caving here. Mm. We're doing serious stuff. People can get hurt. People can die. You know, I brought friends out in body bags. I've nearly lost a team, you know, and I've seen things go bad. And it's like, you know, yes, we're having a great time. We're doing this because we can love to do it, but it doesn't mean that things don't happen.
Yeah.
So it makes me take a leadership, my view of leadership roles very differently than what I once did.
Mm.
And maybe that affects some of my enjoyment sometimes in the cave because there's more pressure of that. But I think it's a good thing too.
Well, yeah. So. I mean, you've certainly carried from that experience.
But the biggest thing was everybody there did their part. Nobody created a scene. Everybody kept their head. Some people had a harder time than others, but everybody did just what they needed to do for us all to get out safely. And then our friends came and got us.
And you did.
Yeah. Yep. And we all got out, and we've kept going back since.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's jump way ahead to Fern Cave.
All right. So as kind of part of this new order, you know, and Binkley's being what it is, Binkley's is kind of a grind, you know. So we try and have some caves that are, we're not great tourist cavers. So when we want to go see something, we want to go really see something.
You want to work it.
Like the through trip in Ellison's or the through trip in Rumbling Falls or, you know, the through trip in Sinking Cove. And we wanted to go to Fern Cave. Marion told great stories about, you know, when she was younger, going in Fern and doing survey and stuff like that. And, you know, Tony talked about, you know, doing Fern Cave when he was like, you know, 16 or something and climbing out on, you know, knots, you know. And,
from Surprise?
And, yeah, and Greg McNamara telling Trips about, you know, dropping, you know, Pitts back in the morgue. And, you know, I'm sitting here, well, Fern is definitely on my list of things that I want to do that I haven't done yet. And so I was prodding Joe Kinder. It's like, all right, because Joe said he could get us tripped Fern Cave. And I mean, not I didn't want to just do Surprise Pit. Once again, just going and bopping a big, deep 404-foot drop pit, you know, that wasn't what I wanted to do.
Sure.
Or not just that. I wanted to see the cave.
Right.
Just like in Ellison, just like in Rumbling Falls, just like, you know, everywhere else we went. I wanted to see the cave. And so Joe put it together. He got a hold of Steve Pitts and got us a what they called a monitoring trip that we could go on with him on Saturday, I think it was. So we get down there early. And so Sunday we decide, go ahead and do Surprise Pit since we're there. It's kind of obligatory. And we do all that and have a great time. It's really cool. I drop down the bottom. Thomas is with us. And of course, I mean, it's just a maelstrom down at the bottom. I have to tell you that the waterfall's coming in and it's spinning all over the place. And we're at the bottom of this 436-foot deep pit, but we're dropping at the 404. And I found a place in the rock, and I got my little camp stove with me, and I've made a cup of tea. And Thomas gets off the rope, and I said, cup of tea? Yeah. I said, I found it's very important to maintain a certain amount of decorum in these type of situations. Thomas just broke out laughing. But that's what we do, you know. I'm known for bringing tea, and so is Mary. But anyway, the next day we went caving with Steve Pitts. Just had an incredible trip. I mean, he started running us through this whole thing. And he was telling us about, you know, the cave and you know, what it had been like to be part of it, you know, in the early days and where it was. And, you know, here's this amazing cave. And they'd started a resurvey project in the late 90s because Bill Trode, I don't know if you know, I mean, he is a giant among cavers, particularly
sure.
Tag cavers, and Bill Cut, you know, Fern has all these name associates, Don Myrick, Bill Cuddington, you know, who's the first to drop Surprise Pit. I mean, Fern's the birthplace of the single rope technique pretty much in the United States. I mean, it's many great cavers, but Bill Trode is a verb. Trojan. I mean, he was known for digging these ledges around Fern in different places and all. I mean, just unbelievable stuff. So this whole cave is just steeped in this, and Steve is telling us these different stories. A number of us have already read, you know, Jennifer Pinkley, his wife's book on the cave and stuff, and so we know things about it, but Steve is this really unassuming kind of quiet man. But he starts talking about the cave, and he hears us, and he remembers Marion. He went caving with her a few times. They had a really good friend in common, J.V. Van Swearingen IV, who was the first liaison between U.S. Fish and Wildlife and cavers and the SCCI.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve assumed that position after his death. Around the time White Nose Syndrome came, they closed the cave. And the survey stopped and the exploration stopped. In 2014, they were Steve and his wife Jennifer were able to renegotiate with Fish and Wildlife access back to Fern Cave because there was vandalism occurring in the cave, spray painting stuff and all. And so they started these monitoring things and they got the survey put back into the special use permit that they have. But really, survey never took back off again. And so, you know, we went off and left that trip and we'd had such a great, you know, time with Steve, and we seemed to kind of bond with him. And it was like, we're going back, you know, gosh, how can it be, you know, that one of the most significant caves in the United States has no ongoing survey and exploration project in it? I mean, it's just like, you know, to us project cavers, this just doesn't make sense. I mean, how can this be that you know, folks aren't actively pursuing stuff in here?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, all the red tape.
Let me make that clear. It's incredibly limited access, except for Fern Cave proper, where Surprise Pit, which is owned by SCCI, mm-hmm. the other entrances are owned and closed by U.S. Fish and Wildlife because of the gray bat. It has a 1.5 million gray bat population, the largest in the world. It's the reason why it became designated as U.S. Fish and Wildlife Preserve. But it was always with the understanding that cavers would have access. And that kind of changed once again with White Nose. But so coming back home, Marion and Tony and I were talking. We were in the same car. And it's like, you know, this just doesn't seem right. I wonder if we came back, you know, maybe Memorial Day, Labor Day, you know, 1, 2, 3 times a year and did a little bit of survey, if that would help spark interest in it and get it going again and all. And so, yeah, we all talked about that. And so I kind of took it upon myself after we got back to reach out to Steve. And I said, Steve, we had such a great time. We've been talking about it, you know. I see such a lot of commonality between the close-knitness of the group that worked in Fern and the close-knitness of our groups and our caving groups. And, you know, I really think that we would be interested in coming and doing, you know, a survey a couple times a year, you know, maybe help get the project jump-started again. And he goes, Rand, I've kind of been stalking your all's Facebook stuff, and you all look like the perfect group to come in here and do the connection between the bottom of Surprise Pit and the lower cave, because that's where the water is and everything. It's going to take wetsuits and everything and all connect this.
Indiana people.
Right, right. The grunge, you know. And he goes, and you know, Marion, she's quite an accomplished, you know, cartographer and everything, you know. In fact, you all might really be perfect to take on the whole project. Would you all be interested? my jaw kind of, you know, I went from, oh, maybe we can help you all get going, to like, you know, here's an offer to take on another project. And I'm sitting going, well, Steve, that's quite an offer here. I think I need to talk to some people, especially Marion, if she's going to take over the map. And of course, we got talking amongst ourselves, and it's like, you know, how do you say no to that?
No.
I mean, the longest cave in Alabama, the second deepest, well, the third deepest drop in continental United States, and, you know, potential for a whole lot more cave. I mean, because nobody's been working this cave.
Yeah.
And we have new lights. We have modern techniques and skills.
You're going to find stuff.
Right. So, yes, it's resurvey, but there's already 9 miles done. Trode had done 16 miles is what he had documented. There's 9 miles, and it's like, what are we going to do? So other than say yes, and we did.
And you did.
And we went into it, you know, head first. Our household is known as Cave Central. It's caving 24/7, 365. I mean, it pretty much is, you know. Yeah. Any free time, it's all caving all day. And it's, if it's not the Binkley's project, then it's the Fern project, and it's not one of those, it's what's the next international trip that we're going to be doing or whatever. And, you know, just so you know, Marion and I, we're engaged, we're in a relationship. Tony, her ex-husband, we're brothers. I mean, literally like that. He actually lives on same property, got another house. I mean, he's engaged to his fiance Aida Fra, who's from Mexico, amazing caver, wonderful woman. So, I mean, we have just at the house this amount of caving knowledge that covers so many different facets available at any moment. You know, all we can do is pretty much talk caves or hiking or camping or something outdoor adventure related and stuff. I mean, there's never a dull moment, really. It's more like, gosh, we haven't taken a break yet. So the Fern Cave has certainly taken kind of a big chunk out of all of our time right now, but we still managed to do Binkley's. We just crossed the 46-mile mark with Binkley's, so that's no small thing. It's still eighth longest in the United States,
man,
according to Longest
Digit
Cave List, although I would say it's probably ninth from what I know. But so we're now, Marion and I are co-managing the Binkley's Cave Project, top 10 cave project in the United States, and the Fern Cave Project, which I would say is top 10 project, maybe not 10 longest cave, but I mean, it's one of the most significant caves. And then we get to do all this international stuff. And Fern Cave is just a playground. I mean, it's a big jungle gym, and it's so wonderful. One Binkley cave trip wipes me out for days. I can go caving 3 days in a row in Fern Cave and not be as tired as after one McLean River trip. You know, I mean, it's just that kind of thing. It's refreshing to be able, but it, once again, it's a vertical playground.
Yeah.
And
not so much crawling and Indiana stuff.
But that's where the leads are, is where the crawls are.
Okay.
But then
that's
where our skills come into play again.
You're equipped.
But right. So, but here I've had to come back once again, confront my fear of vertical and my lack of vertical skills until I was 54, 53. I didn't do anything over 100 foot until I was 53. Mm-hmm. Now I'm regularly doing, 100, 200 foot, 150 foot pits every time we go, several times, in a week. And, we're doing, so in the 20 months that we've taken the Fern project on, we've added a little over 3 miles to the cave map itself.
Gosh,
so we're at like, well, it's over 3 miles. We're at 13 miles and some change, and it was 9.6 when we picked it up.
Yeah.
And we're getting to cave with some of the best cavers out there, up and coming, established. I mean, it's a who's who of in the caving world right now. Many that you've had on your program.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a wonderful environment and great people. And fabulous cave. And I mean, to think at this time in my life, or our lives and our careers, to have this as a regular opportunity. We're going down there every month or 6 weeks, and we're doing 3-day expedition style kind of caving. And we have multiple teams hitting multiple goals for 3 days in a row. And so we're just making leaps and bounds with the progress. Marion's drafting the map, and she's kind of having to develop a new style to illustrate the verticality of it. And so she's trying to combine profile and plan together. And I mean, it's what she's finally arrived with is truly beautiful. It really is. I mean, and how much she has grown in a year is phenomenal, because she's just thrown herself into this. And what she said, well, I can't do this now. Now what she couldn't do is just, that's way behind her, and she's on to this next thing. What she couldn't do before is, something she does all the time.
I can only imagine. I mean, her maps have always been just gorgeous and comprehensive. But this, I'm sure, is flexing her muscles. I'm sure it's challenging her.
It is. It's a real challenge for her. But she is so passionate about it, and she loves it so much, and she will hate that I talk too much about her.
Well, and if anyone rise to the, what I'm saying though is, if anyone can rise to that occasion, it's her where that's concerned.
You're absolutely correct. She can teach herself how to do pretty much anything, and we're a great team together. So between the two of us, this isn't bragging on me, but we really balance each other out. And so I can help her so that she can do what she needs to do. And then I can do the things that I'm good at too, because the things that I can do now are not necessarily the things that I would have done traditionally. I mean, I was the pusher. I was the guy that was always in the front and the lead and doing the hardest hardcore thing. At 62 and a half, I can still do some pretty hardcore things, but I'm not the skinniest guy, and I'm not the best climber, and I'm not this. I have to take some other roles. And so I'm more logistics and organizational. And I mean, there's not much I can't do in the cave, but I'm not the top of the tier in that respect. And
don't have to be, though. You just got to have to be a little bit of everything.
But it is kind of hard to settle into that and say, oh, you mean I could have done that? but the fact of the matter is, I'm still getting to do so much of it. I mean, it's just constant. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
And such a, not to spend too much time on this, but such an impressive and hopeful personal dynamic that you have with Marion and Tony and Aida. It's that, to me, is, I don't want to say like incomprehensible, but that also kind of illustrates and parallels cavers. We can make sense of any social situation or personal situation as long as caving remains the constant, I guess.
If our abilities to problem solve situations are different than most people's, and we have developed relationships in caves where we have to depend upon each other, and those create different boundaries than what most people have. Mm. And once you have established those kinds of boundaries, I think other things are possible that would not normally be.
Clearly.
And this wouldn't work with just anybody. This was this kind of a Goldilocks situation. And, we kind of decided to do this, and do things the way that we did this. And we felt like that it was the adult way to approach this so that we could all continue to do what we love to do and continue to be a team and be around people that we cared about.
Mm. I love it. So it's mid-November when we're talking.
Yep. Yep.
And by the time people hear this, some of this may have already come and gone, but what's coming? What's next?
Well, we have so we're on the precipice, we believe, of a potentially big breakout in Fern Cave right now. So the first weekend in December, we're going to be going back to this lead. I mean, we're finding new cave all the time. About 30% of what we're mapping is cave that has not been explored, that's virgin. So we're out of those 3 miles. And some 3.5 miles, whatever, about a mile of that is new stuff.
Yeah.
So, but we have a chance here, if this goes at all like what we think it could, to break out and be an unknown chunk of the cave system. It may just be a big, massive void that doesn't go anywhere, but it's sure looking like it's a lot more than that. So we've got that on the horizon for the Fern project just in December. So we've got 3 days there. So we're hoping to come out of that with really something. Got a Binkley's Cave trip Thanksgiving weekend, trying to take a scaling pole back into a dome near, heading towards the McLean Mountain Room, that we're trying to find another entrance into. There's passage up there we can see. So going to be pushing that. The 15th of December, Marion and I are heading to go to Peter Sprouse's expedition, and we're going to Purificacion for 2 weeks. And then we actually, since we got engaged in Labor Day weekend, we're going to then fly to Cancun and stay in Playa del Carmen for about 4 days. And then we're going back to the Sierra Mazatec for 3 weeks. And we have a big, massive project up there that has potential to really, really be something we've been looking at for, they've been looking at for decades, and something I've been looking at since I've gotten there. And we're going to get up into the cloud forest there and attack it. So that's all just through the end of January. And then we're back to our regular trips into Fern and to Binkley's. So this is our life right now. And then there's, of course, chance maybe to go back into Vietnam again. didn't talk about going to Vietnam.
We didn't even get
there. Talk about going to Belize, you know, some of the other stuff. I mean, the doors that are opening, actually, really because of the Fern Cave project and the international stuff that we're doing, is just amazing. We were kind of talking earlier, there's no 6 degrees of separation in the caving community.
Not in this world,
and
no.
Once you start doing these kinds of things, if you're competent and capable and of a pleasant enough personality and with some skills, you can write your ticket.
Yeah, I would say so.
So, and to be thinking that I'm still getting to write that ticket, you know, at 62 and a half years of age, I feel just absolutely privileged. I feel privileged to get to work in a cave like Fern. I feel privileged to have had all the experiences and to have gotten to cave with the people that I have in Binkley's Cave, to get to go cave in the longest cave in the world in Rapel, to get to go do all these international things, to know all these amazing, funky, crazy-ass people that are just out there pushing the limits. I mean, it is just so cool. I mean, who would have thought, you know, that I would be getting to do this when I was just this old little base-level caver from southern Indiana, you know, who was raised up in the sinkhole plain and bathed in the waters of Binkley's Cave 30 miles from home all his life, all of a sudden gets to go do this.
Well, isn't that a good illustration of caving? If you just keep doing it, then big stuff comes like that.
I think it's also a good illustration of caving in Indiana.
Yeah.
Project caving in Indiana is freaking hardcore.
Yeah, it's a proving ground.
And it is. It is. And it's been a testing place and a training place for some of the best, with Bill Steele and you know, numerous folks. And if you can cave hardcore in Indiana, you can cave hardcore anywhere I've been, at least so far. And I haven't found anything harder anywhere else than what I've done in Indiana. and I've had as much satisfaction in caves in Indiana as I have anywhere abroad. But there is something special to all of that. And so I feel incredibly privileged. And I'm so, it's so great at this point in my life to be so excited about caving. I've had so many experiences here that we've talked about where it could have easily have been the end of it. And it's like a total good reason to get off and stop and quit, whether it was injury or loss or burnout or whatever. But once again, I'm as excited today, if not more excited, than I was at 15 years of age after my first survey trip in White Christmas Domes, 1977, New Year's Eve. And to think that I can maybe be this until I go to my grave is something that's truly satisfying.
Mm. Well, Nick Benton, how about that?
How about that, Nick?
We fulfilled the request, and in a big, great way. Rand, we've been talking about doing this for a while. I'm so glad we got to, and I'm privileged to call you a friend. And also, after knowing all of that with your vertical kind of hang-ups for a while, knowing that you and I did Indiana's Deepest Pit together for the first time.
That's
for you.
Right. That's right. That was the first time I did it.
I
Gory
feel
hole.
Privileged to have done that.
Well, and then same here, Matt. I just want to express to you what a service I think you're doing to the caving community. You should be so proud of what you've done for us, to have access to the information and to being able to, you know, have this as a repository for cavers that are coming on is just phenomenal. To be able to listen to these firsthand accounts of what people have done for their whole lives is, you know, it's like magic. I'm proud to know you.
Oh, well, thank you, man. Well, we'll check in some other time then, huh?
Absolutely. We're going to have to go caving.
Yeah, we got to.
I mean, that's more what I do than talk. Well, I talk all the time, but I mean, we can talk and cave.
That's fine, too. That's all part of it. Thank you, Rand.
Thank you, Matt.
There you go. Part two of two with Rand Hazlett on the Caving Podcast. Rand, I meant every word. And I know I can never go because of family obligations, but I know the invitation is open. I'm going to try. I'm going to try to get down there to Corydon with you, maybe to the frontier, maybe make Indiana's longest cave a little longer. And, of course, if you want to do that, you, the listener, if you want to go and survey with Rand and be a part of the Binkley Project, you can find Rand on Facebook. He might just invite you. My name is Matt Pelser. One of the best ways to support this podcast is free. You just leave a review on your favorite podcast app. It really, really, really helps. Thank you. And please support caving. Donate to the NSS or your local grotto or your favorite karst conservancy. And support the sponsors of this podcast, past and present. Of course, Sophie Reaptress, our current sponsor, best custom cave suits out there, sophiereaptress.com. And to go with it, get one of the best packs out there, Oswego, swegogear.com. Also, Organic Robot Designs, the screen printing shop in Greenfield, Indiana. But he can handle your order no matter where you are. Organicrobotdesigns.com. And get a Sirius Light from El Spilio, now being sold by On Rope One. Next month, this was such a great talk. Another big one. We'll keep this down to one episode. Dave Brumbaugh. He joined me from his office at Yosemite National Park, and we had such a great conversation. That will come to you March 1st. My name is Matt Pelser from the Central Indiana Grotto. Till next time, kill nothing but time.